Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Criminal Law and Procedure Practice Group, was recorded on Tuesday, July 17, 2016, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call as today we debate the use of cell site simulators. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. I'm very pleased to welcome two experts to our call today. We'll hear opening remarks from each, and then a little bit of back and forth, and then, as always, questions from the audience, so please be thinking of your questions. We're going to hear first from Professor Howard W. Cox. He's an adjunct professor at George Washington University right here in Washington, D.C., and he'll be followed by Professor Brian L. Owsley, who's an assistant professor of law at the University of North Texas Dallas College of Law. Opening remarks of about 8 to 10 minutes from each, but then, as always, we'll be getting to the audience questions. With that, Professor Cox, the floor is yours.
Thank you, Dan. Good afternoon, everyone. Again, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank the Federal Society for agreeing to host what hopefully is going to be a very important topic and a very timely topic on taking a look at people's reasonable expectation in privacy in their cellular communications and what are the legal steps that the government needs to do when the government wants to get access to that kind of information. A couple of introductory remarks here is we're going to be talking here about the law and the technology regarding when your cell phone connects to a cell tower, the kinds of dialogue that takes place between your device and the cell tower, and what the government needs in order to be able to legally obtain that information. We are not talking about seizing content of someone's cell phone or someone's computer. That is clearly determined by the Fourth Amendment and the reasonable expectation of privacy that people have in the content of their cell phones and their computers, and the government is going to need a warrant based upon probable cause in order to get that information. This is a level below that. When your cell phone communicates with a cell tower, a record of that communication is created by your cell phone and is maintained by your carrier. And so the issue is when the government seeks to obtain that kind of information using a Stingray device, and we'll go over in a moment what a Stingray device is, what are your reasonable expectation of privacy in that information, and therefore what kind of legal process the government is going to need in order to get access to that kind of information. The reasonable expectation of privacy standard is obviously a 40-year-old standard based upon a Supreme Court case versus Katz versus the United States, where the court held that if you have an expectation of privacy, that is only going to be recognized if there is a subject expectation by the person claiming privacy, and is society willing to endorse that expectation. And I guess jumping into my conclusion here is my point is that because of the manner in which modern cell phones operate and the manner in which 21st century people know that their cell phones operate, in my opinion, there is no reasonable expectation in this of privacy in this connectivity information, and that it can be obtained with a court order less than that would be required under the Constitution by a search warrant. Very briefly, as I said before, when your phones communicate with a cell tower, a record of that communication is created by the act of communication, and that's maintained as a business record by your cell phone provider. So if you own a cell phone, turn it on, it is automatically communicating with the tower, indicating its availability to send and receive messages. Additionally, cell phones that are smartphones have additional connectivity so that I'm connecting with a Wi-Fi hotspot. And that might be one in Starbucks, it could be one in my home, it could be one in an airport, but there's additional information that my cell phone is automatically broadcasting out to establish connectivity in that particular area. Also, if my cell phone is Bluetooth enabled, it's talking to my car, it's talking to my Fitbit device, and it is sending connectivity area under that. So your cell phones today are very chatty, and they automatically broadcast a broad variety of information. When I make a phone call on my cell phone, additional information and additional content is being sent out. If I'm using my handheld device to browse the internet, additional information regarding my device, my IP address, my operating system are all automatically transmitted to the cell phone provider, to the internet service provider, and to the website I'm communicating with. And if I've also got a cell phone app on my cell phone that allows me, say, for example, to use Google Now, if I have Google Now enabled, well, Google is reading my email. is then telling me that if I have because it reads my email, I've got a flight leaving Dulles Airport in 3 hours. It's sending me a message that knowing where my location is and knowing what the traffic is between my home and Dulles, I need to leave 40 minutes early because traffic is backed up. That kind of information is automatically being broadcasted by my phone without any further input from me based upon the kind of apps that I have enabled on my phone. So this has been a rather robust discussion of when the government is trying to obtain this kind of connectivity information from cell phone providers that keep a record of this connectivity information as a business record, what is the appropriate standard of proof that the government needs to be able to get that kind of information? And right now, every circuit court, and there's approximately five that have addressed this, have all held uniformly that people do not have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that connectivity data. And therefore, the government can obtain that data with something less than a search warrant. And the two primary forms of legal authority that the government has used to obtain that information from a carrier is the Pentrat Statute, 18 U.S.C. Section 3121 through 3127, and that provides for a court order when the court concludes that information is sought is likely to be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. And also the government has used the authority of the Stored Communications Act, 18 U.S.C. Section 2703D, which again is an ex parte application based upon specific and articulable facts that there are reasonable grounds to believe that the records sought are relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. So every circuit court that has examined this particular issue up to and including a decision that came out from this Fourth Circuit about a month ago has held that there is no reasonable expectation of privacy in this connectivity data, that users know that their cell phones are providing this information to third parties. And so therefore, since they're providing it to third parties, they don't have an expectation of privacy, and that the government can use something short of a search warrant to be able to get access to this kind of information when it's in the hands of a cell phone provider. So let's change the factual scenario just a little bit and talk about then, well, how does the Stingray device enter into this? And the device has a variety of different names. Stingray is probably the most popular name that has been attributed to it. But what a Stingray is, for all intents and purposes, it's a small handheld or vehicle-mounted government cell tower. And again, going back to how your cell phones communicate, your cell phone seeks out the closest cell phone tower and establishes connectivity with that cell phone tower. What the purpose of Stingray is that the Stingray is a small portable cell phone tower that will operate on a short-term basis and on a short-range basis that is primarily used by the government to find people who are fugitives. And so therefore, these devices cause cell phones in the area to communicate the kind of information that would normally be directly communicated to AT&T, Verizon, your cell phone provider, and instead is provided directly to a government device. The government then sorts the kinds of information that is provided in the hopes of identifying a specific cell phone. Again, content is not provided. What the government is acquiring under these circumstances is what is the connectivity data that is being shared with the local cell phone tower, and instead is being shared with the government's mini cell phone tower. So the legal issues regarding this device are interesting. There are very few decided cases, but most of the legal issues surrounding the use of these particular devices, and right now it's estimated that most federal law enforcement agencies have them, and over 60 different state and local organizations also have these kinds of devices. The legal issues seem to be primarily predominant in two areas. Number one, what standard of judicial approval should be sought by the government in order to be able to use a Stingray device? And the division is there, it should either be based upon the probable cause standard with a warrant based upon probable cause, or one of the lesser standards that are reflected in the Pentrap Statute or in the Stored Communications Act. A separate issue that has also arisen is how much should be provided to the court that is authorizing these orders regarding the use and operation and capabilities of this device. And the reason why that's an issue is that the FBI, a number of years ago, insisted upon an historic level of secrecy regarding the use of these particular devices. and would require that federal, state, and local organizations that were trying to use these devices had to sign a non-disclosure agreement whereby they would refuse or as a condition of being able to get to use the device, they would have to be less than perhaps fully forthcoming regarding the use of the device and its capabilities. And that, unfortunately, has created a sinister appeal for this particular device. There's been a number of red herrings, in my opinion, that have been thrown out by members of the privacy bar that have suggested that the use of this device is particularly sinister because it might at one point have been an intelligence tool or might have the capability to wiretap. And on that particular point, I would like to observe that all devices the government uses for pen traps have the capability to wiretap. But the government is not using those devices, for, at least to my knowledge, for wiretap purposes unless the requirements of the Title III wiretap statute have been met. So while these devices may have that capability, it is not turned on. But because there were some concerns by a variety of courts regarding the secrecy surrounding these devices, and there was a good deal of congressional pressure, to change the approach that was taken here, the Justice Department in September of last year issued a Department of Justice-wide policy on the utilization of Stingray devices. And I think the policy does a variety of really good things. Number one, it does require that a warrant be used in all applications unless there is an exigent circumstances that is present. Secondly, it requires that law enforcement organizations that want to use this device have to put an appropriate level of supervisory control. So it's just not left to the local investigator. An appropriate level of supervisory control within the law enforcement agency is going to have to go along. Coordination with the Justice Department is required in all circumstances. Fulsome disclosure of the existence of the device and its capabilities has to be provided to the court the application is being made in front of. And the traditional controls that the law and the Justice Department have required on minimization of overcollection and retention of third-party records is clearly now applied to the use of Stingray devices. In my opinion, the only downside of it is that we're dealing here with data that, in my opinion, people don't have a reasonable expectation of privacy in. And when we're using the warrant standard, I think there's the possibility that could result in a dilution of the third-party doctrine, which I think is an important one and should be diluted, but should be properly explained under electronic communications. My final point is this. That in the modern day and age when cell phone devices are configured to communicate at all times, that users of those devices are aware of the fact that the devices are communicating at all times, that a record of that communication is going to be maintained by their cell phone provider, that it defies logic and the current understanding of how cellular technology operates to contend that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy in that cellular connectivity data. Let me state it another way. Can we reasonably state that in a society where millions of people are out every day playing Pokemon Go all over the United States, that these folks are unaware of the fact that their cell phones are sharing information with cellular carriers, ISP, and websites, and that they have a reasonable expectation of privacy in this publicly broadcasted data? I'm troubled by judicial findings of a reasonable expectation of privacy in this data, be it in the hands of the carrier or in the hands of the government, and I'm concerned that this undercuts 40 years of development of the third-party doctrine. If there is to be an expectation of privacy in this, it's a new one, and that's the province of Congress to go ahead and define new rights of privacy, and I believe that that's the appropriate, if this is the kind of information that needs to be properly protected, Congress is the right place to do it. Brian.
Thank you, Professor Cox. So I want to step back and talk about briefly how the I want to elaborate further on how cell site simulators work. So we all have cell phones, and you know we typically are working on a 4G or a 3G network. And how the device works is it basically mimics a cell phone tower, and it jams 4G and 3G service and provides a default to 2G service. And so all the cell phones that are operating in a given radius will believe that the device is the nearest cell tower and register with it briefly. And that information is then downloaded via the device onto a computer. So in other words, you're getting not just the target cell phone, but a lot of other data from other third parties. And so, for example, let me give you three scenarios how I understand that the government in law enforcement typically uses cell site simulators. And I'm going to go from what I would characterize as the least invasive to the most invasive. So the least invasive approach is Brian Owsley is a known drug dealer. Law enforcement is trying to track me down, bring me in or whatever, and they know that I have a specific cell phone number, and so they know generally where I tend to hang out, and so they're using this device to see if my cell phone number is registering in the radius. That's one way in which this device can be used. The second approach is, again, Brian Owsley is a known drug dealer. He uses cell phones to engage in the trafficking of narcotics, law enforcement is not certain of what number the cell phone number is that he's currently using, and they want that information to further their investigation. So they know that I live at a certain location, and they will go there with the device, and they will initiate the downloading of information, and they will get a large number of cell phone numbers in that radius. Then they will follow the suspect, in this case Brian Owsley, the drug dealer, to various locations. Maybe he'll go to a restaurant or to a club or to a meeting or whatever it is. And at multiple sites, they will download data in those areas. And the hope is at the end of the day, they will have a couple of numbers that are registering at every location, and then they will go from there. They will investigate those numbers. That's sort of the second way this is used. And then the third one, you have examples of, we have protests now in the United States over a myriad of issues. It doesn't matter, but the most notable example that I'm aware of is in Baltimore after Freddie Gray's, death. There were use of stingrays on either helicopters or I think probably more likely Cessnas to fly in the Baltimore area to track cell phone numbers of people who were at protesting over a series of days. And I characterize that, excuse me, as the most invasive, because essentially they're not trying to track any one individual. They're not trying to do anything other than sort of download data. So those are the three. I want to get back to what Professor Cox was talking about, the applications in this regarding. He was talking about pen registers and the Stored Communications Act. Now, in my experience in reviewing these types of applications, I have never seen an application that is pursuant to the Stored Communications Act. So if Professor Cox has seen them, I have not, and I can't speak to that. In my experience, the applications are done pursuant to pen registers. And so I want to be clear what a pen register is, because I think this is critical to our understanding. A pen register, in conjunction with its partner, the trap and trace device, is essentially a request for outgoing and incoming telephone numbers. So for those of you who are of a certain generation like I am, if you remember when your home phone number had a caller ID, that's a trap and trace device. Essentially, it was recording and showing the data of all the incoming calling numbers. And the converse is the pen register, which is a list of all the outgoing numbers. And so when magistrate judges review pen register applications, they are viewing something that has a very low threshold for granting it, and something with a specific purpose, and most notably a pen register pursuant to the statute and pursuant to the case law indicates a known number. So, for example, if you go back to my the three scenarios, the first one, they know Brian Owsley, drug dealer's cell phone number. So you can get a pen register for that. The other two scenarios, they don't have that. So using a pen register is outside of that scope, I think. So following up or sort of juxtaposed to what Professor Cox was saying, I think that the appropriate course, and I think that stingrays are a valuable tool in many law enforcement's arsenals in combating crime, but I think the appropriate course for seeking permission to utilize a pen register, I mean a cell site simulator, is through a search warrant seeking based on probable cause consistent with the Constitution. That is my benchmark, and one of the reasons I would say that is, as we heard Professor Cox allude to, Congress has enacted various statutes, the Stored Communications statute, there's the pen register statute authorizing that. Congress has not addressed stingrays. And in my opinion, when there's a gap, when Congress hasn't addressed something, the default should be the Constitution and the Fourth Amendment. And so I think that's the appropriate course. One of the reasons I'm concerned about the use of cell site simulators for less thresholds is this third-party data that's being gathered. Regardless of when it's being used, the cell site simulator is always gathering data, and I don't know what the government does with it. I don't have any reason to believe that they're getting rid of it. They are not saying that they're getting rid of it in any meaningful way. So those are the two principal concerns that I have. And sort of going back to the final point on Congress, I would welcome Congress to step in and address use of stingrays by law enforcement in the context of law enforcement's role. That would be phenomenal. I think most magistrate judges, I'm a former magistrate judge, would welcome guidance from Congress. The problem is we have, regardless of which side of the aisle, a largely dysfunctional Congress, and they can't seem to do any of that. There is some good experimentation or developments on state levels where various states, but that sends some mixed messages. We've heard Professor Cox talking about reasonable expectation of privacy and his approach to that, but you can be in a state where the depending on whether you're in federal court or state court, the what a reasonable expectation of privacy would vary different greatly. So with that, I'm going to pass it back to Dean Reuter, and he will open it up from there, I think.
Terrific. Thank you both. Let's do open it up to the audience for questions. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question for either or both of our experts, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. Let me start things off here as we wait to see if anybody rings in with a question. You mentioned, Professor Cox, the DOJ controls, the policy statement that the Department of Justice has on the use of cell site simulators. You alluded to some of the controls and maybe even mentioned a couple of them. I wonder if you want to spend a few minutes going into that a little bit further.
Yeah, sure. In response to a number of congressional oversight hearings, the Justice Department last September decided to issue a policy document that's binding on all federal law enforcement investigations. And the policy document basically says that it shall be the policy of the Department of Justice to only apply for stingray based upon a warrant issued either under Rule 41 of the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure or under the Pen Trap Statute. So however much I might feel that that's an overly cautious approach, it is one that the Justice Department has chosen to take as a matter of policy. In addition to that policy statement, it also then requires then that a supervisory level of approval has to be obtained by the law enforcement agency. So it's not just some rogue FBI agent that's decided to use this particular technology. It has to be done at a supervisory level. There has to be coordination with the Justice Department. And the coordination is up to and including mild section of the Justice Department, the computer crime section, which is going to provide some degree of uniformity of how this is going to be done across the board. Also, to address a legitimate point that Professor Owlsley just brought out, is this, that these devices can and do connect and collect information from third parties. So how long is that information, what is the government going to do with that information, how long are they going to hang on to it? This policy document specifically identifies that information on someone other than the target will be deleted after a day. Or I believe there's another set of circumstances where it could be retained for 30 days, but is not going to be used. So therefore, I believe that these appropriately address issues regarding over-collection and retention. The other thing that I picked up on looking at a number of the court decisions that have come out regarding the stingrays is that a lot of times when the judges sit down and ask the applicants, be that the assistant U.S. attorney or the law enforcement organization, they haven't all been happy with the level of information that they've gotten and the knowledge and awareness of the applicants on what this device is and how it's going to be used. And I think that's caused by two things. Number one, there was a lack of adequate training. And number two, this former FBI policy really prohibited or forbid these people from being as fulsome as they should be with the court. And I believe the Justice Department policy is designed to eliminate that uncertainty and make certain that courts are more fully informed as to how these devices are going to be used, what kind of data they're going to be collecting, and how long that data is going to be maintained.
Very good. Professor Owlsley, do you have anything on this point?
Well, I would say, the latter point about the candor of the government. In my experience, I know that I had an assistant United States attorney with an application for use of a stingray, and her argument was essentially, oh, judge, if you knew what I knew. Well, that's never going to be persuasive to a judge, you know, considering whether or not to sign any order. I mean, you don't have to give everything, but you have to give enough to convince an individual judge that she or he should sign whatever, you know, order you're requesting, whether it's stingray or other. One of the things that is brought out by Professor Cox's point about the DOJ policy. One, their policy is great, but it's not binding on them on some level. So in other words, it goes right up to saying we're going to do search warrants and probable cause based on probable cause, but it's not saying it's doing that because it's bound to do that by the Constitution. The concern I have with that is if there's a situation where they feel the need to use a stingray device, the argument would be we didn't have to follow our own policy. We decided we didn't have to follow our own policy, and it's not violative of the Constitution. On the point about the pen register, I think the policy guidance is addressing this a little bit. If you come into a magistrate judge with an application for a pen register and a magistrate judge knows what a pen register means, it's a term of art along the lines of what I've discussed earlier, and it's a low threshold. Essentially, if the agent comes in and has a pulse, the magistrate judge has a pulse, there's going to be a pen register signed. If you come in with a stingray device request that says it's a pen register, that I think is very disingenuous, and I think that concerns a lot of at least magistrate judges that sort of playing a little bit fast and loose, at least with terminology. And to the extent that the doctrine issued last September by DOJ is sort of correcting that, I think that's a step in the right direction. Finally, Professor Cox talked about what's going on at the federal level, and I think that's great. I mean, uniformity at the federal level is something that would be, I think, very useful here. But then we have 50 different states, and we're sort of like these devices are in state and local law enforcement hands. They're going to state judges, and so there's that whole sort of issue if we're concerned about privacy and the collection of this data as well. So that's sort of the final thought I had about Professor Cox's remarks.
Well, once again, this is Dean Reuter. If you're in the audience, if you have a question, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. We've got about a half an hour left, plenty of time, and happy to take your questions. In terms of a commercial announcement here now, tomorrow at 2 p.m., our Teleform conference call, it's the same number, 2 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be discussing the Internet of Things. And then Thursday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, we'll be talking about what's next in the area of compulsory union dues. Today, of course, we're talking about self-site simulators. If you have a question, push the star button and the pound button on your telephone. Seeing no questions just yet, let me ask either one of you about an OLC opinion. We've heard about the DOJ policy, which Professor Owsley's concern is that can be avoided as needed. Is there anything like an OLC opinion on the use of cell site simulators and whether or not they're any sort of Fourth Amendment analysis for cell site simulator use?
I'm not aware of any, but Professor Cox may be.
Yeah, I mean, from my time at the Justice Department, as well as the research I've done 5 years since I left DOJ, I'm not aware of anything. I know that the Privacy Bar, the ACLU, and the Electronic Freedom Foundation have been very aggressive in using the Freedom of Information Act to expose a lot of the Department of Justice and law enforcement guidance here, and I haven't seen anything that they've found in that particular area. So my impression is primarily the September DOJ guidance is the overall guiding point that exists in this area. If I can just respond also to just one thing that Professor Owsley had indicated before, is that, I mean, obviously the law enforcement has to obey the Constitution, and the constitutional controls over this kind of information fall back on reasonable expectations of privacy. And I think the case law regarding this data being broadcasted by phones and being provided to cell carriers has pretty much established that people don't have an expectation of privacy. And so, therefore, something less than a warrant would be an appropriate legal matter of getting this. Now, whether or not that analysis and that conclusion is changed when this information is not gathered by a third party that someone has contracted with, your cell phone carrier, and is now instead being gathered by the government, I think is an interesting discussion that most of the courts that have addressed this issue haven't confronted yet. But my argument is that this basic connectivity data, people don't have an expectation of privacy in it, and so therefore, under constitutional principles, something short of a search warrant is the appropriate legal standard.
We do have a caller with a question. If you'd like to join that queue, push the star button, then the pound button on your telephone. For now, let's take our first call of the day.
Hi, good afternoon. This is Chris Gardner. I'm an attorney down in Virginia. Professor Cox, you mentioned that you were worried about erosion of the third-party doctrine, and I was wondering if you thought that was more of a fear or less of a fear in light of the fact that it already seems to be going in that direction, and we've seen some Supreme Court decisions, whether it was the Riley case, whether it was the opinions written by Judge Ginsburg coming out of the D.C. Circuit, and the Jones v. Mayard case. It already seems to be kind of going that way, and so I was wondering if you think that it is really that much of a fear, or if that doctrine needs to be revisited anyhow.
Thank you. I mean, it's a real good question. The concern that I have really comes from, if you take a look at the advocacy that the Privacy Bar has made on getting historical cell site information from carriers, one step short of the dialogue that we're having here about the government getting it. And the Privacy Bar has attempted to make the argument that despite the fact that cell phones have been talking to carriers for years and people don't have an expectation of privacy in that data, they are seeking to have the courts establish that when I give this connectivity information to Verizon, somehow I have an expectation of privacy despite the fact that the third party doctrine, which has been around for 40 years, says, hey, if I give information to a third party, I don't have an expectation of privacy in it. And using Riley and some of the other more recent Supreme Court decisions on electronic evidence, you know, none of the arguments that have been raised is, well, the fact that everybody is using a cell phone nowadays now creates an expectation of privacy in that data that didn't exist 10 years ago when not as many people were using cell phones. And that just seems to be illogical to me. Another argument that I see being raised is, well, because of the volume of data that these devices are sharing, somehow I have a greater expectation of privacy when I share more data with a third party. That also doesn't seem to be logical to me. So my concern is that an erosion of the third party doctrine when we're talking about electronic records is problematic, not just in the use of cell sites, but also in gathering historic data.
Professor Owsley, you want to jump in here?
Yeah, sure. So, one, I think the caller does identify a trend, at least. I mean, when you see Justice Alito and Justice Sotomayor sort of both critical of some of the components of the third-party doctrine, I think you start to have a potential where maybe it's time to revisit. Let's put a little historical context on the development of the third-party doctrine so we understand what we're talking about. I mean, the first case that handled this was developed this was U.S. versus Miller. It's a bank teller case, and the idea was you are giving information to a bank teller, i.e. a third party, during a transaction. And so that was sort of the launching point. And then Smith versus Maryland, the idea, it was a pen register case, and the idea was you're giving information to the phone company historically through operators, telephone operators. Traditionally, in the third-party doctrine as it was developed, there was a third individual involved. In this day and age, when you go and get money from the bank, you're typically using the ATM. You're not interacting with a human person, another human being. Similarly, in the use of cell phones, you're not interacting with a phone operator. So I think that the third-party doctrine in this day and age may need to be revisited and reassessed as to its applicability and how far we want it to extend over everything we do. Because otherwise, the flip side is potentially everything is covered by some third-party doctrine, and there's really virtually very little reasonable expectation of privacy anywhere maybe outside of one's personal residence.
And I mean, I'm in agreement that there's a declining in the expectation of privacy, but let's go back to Miller for a moment. Okay, you know, and some have been trying to make the argument that, oh, back in the day, I would cash my check in front of a teller, and so there's a level of personal contact that was there. Trouble is, later on, under Miller and before, when you were subpoenaing to get records of that check, you weren't subpoenaing the bank record, the bank teller. You were subpoenaing Wells Fargo as an organization. And as the Supreme Court indicated in Smith versus Maryland, it used to be we used to deal with telephone operators all the time. The technology has now migrated to the point where it's been automated. We're not dealing with phone operators. We're dealing with electronic switching equipment. And the court in Smith versus Maryland, the Supreme Court observed that that didn't lessen or rather create a heightened expectation of privacy that we're living in a more automated world. So, again, my argument is today that because we communicate in this manner in an automated manner, we know how much our devices are sharing. And that means that we, I believe, are demonstrating a lesser expectation of privacy, not a greater one.
So a couple points along that line. One, I think Professor Cox may be giving people more credit than they deserve in the sense of I don't know that people fully realize that they are basically just giving their information willy-nilly. I understand, you know, his Pokemon Go reference and stuff like that, but the notion that your typical cell phone user understands the implication of doing Pokemon Go, which I don't understand at all, but I'm not sure is there. Two, and this is maybe a weak branch to stand on because there's not a lot of data or information about there, but when sociologists query individuals about their expectations of privacy, they tend to score very high. In other words, people want and expect a high degree of privacy on things like their cell phones. Now, there's not a lot of data done by sociologists or law professors or legal institutes to get at that information. But the limited information out there does show that people do want and expect a high degree of privacy in these types of arenas. And given, you know, as Professor Cox has referred to, some commentators noting the ubiquitous nature of cell phones, people may expect a higher degree of privacy in it and demand it going forward. And that can alter the landscape as courts develop it.
Okay. And, you know, and I agree with everybody up to a point when it was the last line, that to the extent that there is an expectation of privacy there, I believe that would be a new one. And that's one that's properly delineated by Congress, not by trying to retrofit our historic views on the third-party doctrine and say because people are using cell phones more, they now have a greater expectation through greater use.
I would, and I go back to my earlier point, I would love for Congress to come in and sort of provide some guidance here. And I think most judges would as well. But in the absence of that guidance from Congress, or if you're in the state court, the state legislature, a judge, she or he has to just make a determination based on a myriad of factors. And so that's why you're starting to see some of these comments by Justice Alito or Justice Sotomayor. That's why you're starting to see the Southern District of New York, a judge up there, suppressed evidence just earlier this month that was obtained by a cell site simulator. So, judges are going to have to make decisions in the absence of any guidance by Congress. I think it would be preferable for Congress to act, but I am also realistic enough to know in this day and age of sort of political tensions, notwithstanding even the fact that we're in an election year, because this has been going on for at least a decade, that Congress is not inclined to go forward and provide guidance.
Let me make another call for questions here. If you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Let me ask another question then, of Professor Cox. I think Professor Owsley mentioned his third example, his most, which he characterized as, I guess, the most intrusive example, and that's the use of this device to sort of monitor an entire crowd of protesters in Baltimore. Does that give you pause? You mentioned these things being sort of customized, the use of this being customized to a target, which to me connotes an individual person. So if the Baltimore stuff happened, is everyone a target in that circumstance, or how do you work your concept of a target into surveillance of a mass of people?
Well, you know, as a general mass surveillance device, I don't know if the Penchop statute allows general mass surveillance. And so, therefore, even under the lesser standard of the Penntrap statute, the government still has to be able to certify that the information sought is likely to be relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. And so to try to contend that I want the cell phone of all 5,000 people that are protesting on East Howard Street in Baltimore doesn't seem like it is information that is relevant to an ongoing criminal investigation. It seems to be a broad overstatement. Again, I'm not familiar with the case that Professor Owsley is mentioning there, but and I've, I'm not a magistrate judge, but I would look askance if somebody was just going to try to use a device like this under the criminal justice statutes for what amounts to mass surveillance. And I believe that there should be, and I believe that there are appropriate controls that would prevent that. Sometimes those controls haven't been properly used in the past. And if I can for a moment, the district court case that Professor Allah just mentioned is a case called United States versus Lambus, and it was decided about 2 weeks ago by a judge in the Southern District of New York. And in that particular case, the DEA applicant, they didn't use any judicial process to authorize the device in question, the Stingray device in question. They had gotten a warrant to get historic cell site information, and then without any additional judicial authorization, sought to use a pen trap. In my opinion, I think that was inappropriate, and I think the court acted appropriately in controlling that.
Maybe a question for Professor Owsley. Is there a corollary here with facial recognition technology? These people, the Baltimore protesters, that is, they were out in public. They knew probably they were being videotaped. I mean, there were, in any organized protest nowadays, there are dozens and dozens of cameras and a lot of news cameras a lot of times, so official press out there documenting things. Does it make a difference where this happens? Whether it's in someone's home or whether they're out in public protesting?
We live in a very complicated world. So, if you go back to Maynard, the D.C. Circuit decision that talks about, that leads up to Jones, which is one of the cases that Alito and Sotomayor are talking about. I mean, one of the concerns is basically just gathering of all kinds of data that leads to a big picture of one's private life. So I'm not sure that taking pictures of a protest or face recognition is problematic in a specific context. But, for example, here's one sort of, I guess, broaden the discussion then. License plate readers. So many jurisdictions use license plate readers, and there's an example out in Oakland where an individual had their license plate read several hundred times, and that information, and that's just from driving around the city of Oakland, and that information in reasonably analytical individual's hands could give you guidance as to where that person worked, where they lived, you know, other issues or other things about their lives. So I think the concern is sort of, is there sort of this ability to gather information on a broad scale to learn about people's just personal intimate lives? And, you know, arguably, if you call an abortion clinic on your cell phone, is that protected, not protected? I mean, under the Penn Register third-party doctrine approach that Professor Cox is espousing, basically, because you're using your cell phone, you understand that you're interacting with a third party, i.e. your carrier, and so therefore that's not really protected information. Or if you're calling, you know, your gynecologist, or you're expecting, or you may be expecting, you're getting the results. Or you're, I mean, so there's all kinds of things that are, you know, sort of going on. And people, I think, at the end of the day, want to have some kind of bubble of privacy.
What about that, Professor Cox? As technology advances, you know, corporations, Google and others, and businesses and governments have the ability to access more and more of your previously private information. Sometimes with your consent, sometimes it's opt-in, opt-out, but what happens to the bubble of privacy? The Kylo case is maybe one example where and this, I think, had to do with the definition of a search rather than the reasonable expectation of privacy, but the case, the Supreme Court case, involved the use of a heat monitoring device that did not go into the home, but from the exterior of a home, you could detect heat.
Yes.
And from that, they surmised that this person was growing marijuana with grow lights and got a warrant and then searched the home.
And clearly under Kylo, they stated when the government is using a kind of technology that isn't readily available in a manner such as that, it is conducting a search, and that that would be inappropriate without, you know, a search warrant. Okay, well, the triple Fourth Amendment jurisprudence says you're doing a search. Search means you're searching an area. Someone has a reasonable expectation of privacy. You need a warrant. Let's back that up under cell phone technology. And there's been one, you know, law review article recently published that had talked about the ubiquitous nature of cell site catchers, how easily these things are to be able to make, and how it might be a more readily available source of technology. So that sort of addresses one piece of Kylo. The other piece that I would have dealing with Kylo is, and this is one of the concerns I have with the district court decision from New York a couple of weeks ago, is that, you know, the cell Stingray devices cause your cell phone to communicate with the government's cell phone cell site simulator. So is the act of causing a communication device to communicate with a government device a search? And I go back to a very recent Supreme Court decision from 2013 talking about, well, if the is knocking on the doorway, okay, a search. You knock on the door to see if somebody answers. If somebody answers, is that a search? And the Supreme Court ruled 3 years ago, that's not a search. Girl Scouts do that when they go to sell cookies. Door-to-door salesmen do that. So the fact that the law enforcement is knocking on your door to see whether or not you answer the door is not a search. I would argue that your communication devices that you intend to communicate with others, if the government happens to get that information that you intend to communicate to others, that is not a search, and something less than a search warrant is the appropriate legal authority.
Law enforcement knocking on the door is not a search. Law enforcement approaching your door with a drug-sniffing dog, however, is a search. You know, of anything in the curtilage, as the court said. So, and I would say a drug sniffing dog is not really new technology. But the problem, I think, you know, one, I'm not sure what's more ubiquitous, cell site simulators or thermal heat measuring devices. At one point, I'm sure it was probably more the thermal heat devices because I think they predated cell site simulators. I don't know that, I mean, one of the sort of, I guess, concerns about that argument is you have Harris Corporation and others like it who basically flooded the marketplace with cell site simulators and that sort of ability on their part to just flood the market shouldn't mean that there's sort of a reduced expectation of privacy or usage, concerns about usage by the government. That I don't think that's a good argument.
Well, yeah, but the reason why I don't accept the drug-sniffing dog analogy is that the drug-sniffing dog is sniffing drugs, which aren't designed to be a communications device. The difference here is that what you are sniffing with a cell site simulator or a Stingray device is the communication signals that the owner of the device intends for this device to send out. And so searching a communications device in these circumstances, I think, is a horse of a different color than, you know, the comparison with a dog sniff. I think it's more akin to knocking on the door to see who answers. And if I don't want my cell phone to answer, turn it off.
I don't think cell phone users are intending to send out messages to the government in general.
But they are intending to send it out to third parties. They are intending to send it out to their cell phone carriers. The, you know,
I don't think that most people have that sophisticated understanding of how a cell phone works.
The Fourth Circuit last month basically stated, look, in order to establish knowledge of what their phone devices are doing, the fact that their devices are telling them that they're doing this, and the fact they sign user agreements acknowledging what their devices are doing, that's sufficient under the Fourth Amendment.
Well, gentlemen, we don't have another question from the audience, but we have a couple minutes left. Let me give each of you, let's go in reverse order than when we started, but let me give each of you a chance to express a final thought or wrap up. Professor Owsley.
Okay. So, again, I'm going to just echo a couple of points I made at the beginning. You know, my take is that in the absence of congressional guidance, there is no specific statute at the federal level that deals with cell site simulator devices, and consequently, the default should be the Fourth Amendment. If Congress disagrees with that, then Congress is willing, entitled to come in and step in and provide guidance and legislation. I think that there is a concern about what is going on with the collection of data. There's the Baltimore example that I gave you, which I do think predates the September policy doctrine by DOJ, but I have no belief or no way of knowing whether they're still doing that type of thing. But I think, and as the caller earlier alluded to, I think this is an issue that's percolating. There are only probably, I can think of, only a couple of decisions that actually address the use of stingrays, and including the one earlier this month about suppressing the evidence collected by it. It's going to percolate more. I don't think the a circuit court has addressed the use of stingrays and whether or not that is permissible. I think that and issues revolving or related to the third-party doctrine are going to percolate, and we will see where the trend line goes.
Professor Cox, a final thought?
Okay, thank you. I'm agreeing with Professor Owsley that in the absence of legislative action, and I'm equally disappointed with the likelihood of that action happening anytime soon, I think courts are going to have to go back to a more traditional Fourth Amendment analysis. And the Fourth Amendment analysis should be driven by, is what the government is doing in these particular circumstances with a device like this a search? If it is a search, then the government needs to be getting a warrant. And that's as a policy statement, the government is conceding they're going to be using warrants from this point forward, at least on the federal level. But my argument is that this kind of connectivity data is not a search. Obtaining this kind of connectivity data is not a search. And some judicial approval short of a search warrant, I think, is the prudent course to take.
Well, gentlemen, this is Dean Reuter again. Thank you both for joining us today. It's good to hear from both of you, hear your different views on this interesting topic. Thank you both for joining us. And to the audience, thank you as well for dialing in. A reminder that our next scheduled Teleforum conference call will be tomorrow at 2 p.m. Eastern Time at this same number. We'll be discussing the Internet of Things. But until the next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at fedsoc.org/multimedia.